a little bit in the edges, but I think all the important information should be on there. Andrew said this was going to be in the small room. I think something went wrong with the booking anyway.
People like you.
Obviously, nobody knows what I'm going to say then, because we've got a break somewhere in the middle so you can leave. Okay. My name is Jess Sorensen. I work at the European Laboratory for Particle Physics. You may have heard of it. It's a place where there's a lot of mad physicists accelerating particles and breaking them. And they're also doing other weird things like inventing the web and stuff like that. I work there in the physics data processing group, which is basically the group which is running most of the big computers used by the physicists for simulation and analysis of the data. I also happened to have been working in Linux for about a bit more than 5 years. I'm in my spare time, I'm the maintainer for Linux on the 68000. I also do at work, I've done gigabit Ethernet, well, gigabit networking drivers, various other kernel hacking. So that's my background. So basically, I started out at some point, had a computer. Linux didn't really do what I wanted. They couldn't display the console in the way I needed it, so I had to find out how to change it. That's how it started for me. I guess that's how it started for most people, that it's almost there, but not quite, so I had to modify something myself to go. Okay, so I've given this talk once before in public. That was at the Linux Expo in Raleigh in May. I made a few changes to the slides since then because Linux doesn't stop releasing kernels, so I had to update a few things to make them compliant. But other than that, it should be, at least it's been tested before, so I hope, and unless somebody has been using my machine while I have been sleeping or at a bar, then it should be at least tried out. Okay, so the program for today is fairly long. I do not expect to be able to teach you how to program the kernel. So I'm going to give an overview of the things which you would, which I expect you to benefit from if you want to start programming the kernel. So you have I'm going to give an overview of many of the features you're likely to see if you want to try and program the kernel. Because the only way you can learn to program the kernel is learn by doing. There's no other way. I mean, some people also believe that you can take a programming course and learn to program C. I mean, that's crap. It doesn't work like that. My approach is basically that I expect most of the things people want to do are device drivers. It's the classical thing. You have a card which doesn't work in your Linux machine, and you want to. That's the main angle towards it. It's the things you'll see in that case. I'm not going to cover the things like file system, how to wire the file system, how the buffer caches work, and that sort of thing. Half of it I don't know. So the agenda is I'll give a short introduction to how the kernel is put together, how the tree looks, what you find where in the tree, about the versions of the kernels. I think you know most of this already, but I'll jump over it quickly. Then I'm going to look at also quickly how you compile your own kernel, how it's configured. Then I'll look at how the kernel is booting, basically. How the kernel is initialized and started up, because that's an important thing to know when you're starting to write code. So you have an idea about when I get here in the kernel, I can expect these subsystems to work, so you don't try to use something which is not yet initialized and the whole thing blows up. Then I'll look at the most important debugging tool we have. It's called printk. You probably know printf from user space. Then memory allocations, what address spaces we have in the kernel, how to find your devices, ask the hardware if it's got some of the stuff you want to see. Then we got interrupts and various other things, how to copy things between the kernel and user space, how to do waiting in the kernel. So the first slide is sort of the simple stuff, and the second agenda page is a little bit more advanced stuff. That's basically the funny stuff. I'll probably spend more time on this, but I'm going to take a break somewhere. I'm supposed to take a break at around 10:45, I think. I'll try to keep it, but otherwise start snoring, and I'll take a break then. I'll look at locking mechanisms, system calls, privileges, kernel threads, I/O controls, how to write code which is portable. So as you all know, Linux runs on 7, 8, 10 different architectures nowadays. So I'll look at how to write portable code, how to write code which is working in both the current and the older kernels. Then we got exciting things like SMP, how to deal with their symmetric multiprocessing. More and more people are getting SMP boxes, and it can be done reasonably easy. If you want a good performance, that's a different story. Then I'll look at some more tricks about how to put your data together, and in the end, I'll look a bit at debugging. So, okay, cell phones, please switch them off, by the way. Okay, the kernel versions, as you probably all know, we have the stable and the unstable kernels. The stable kernels, well, they've got like three digits in their numbers, or three sub-numbers. Right now, we're in the 2.x series, and the current stable kernel is 2.2.10, I think. I think Linus hasn't put up 2.2.11 yet. He has? No, 2.2. Anyway, and we have the developers kernels, which are the 2.x series, with the x not being an even number. Developers kernels are, they're supposed to be unstable. They're allowed to be unstable. Things are allowed to break and blow up totally. So if you're playing with developers kernels, expect things may be strange. I'll mainly focus on 2.2, but I have a few slides on what's happening in 2.3, so you can make sure your code will work in both. Other than that, everybody probably knows that Linux maintains the kernel tree, and then there's some modules which are available from third parties, like the PCMCIA stuff. Also some of the non-Intel architectures, because it's sometimes pretty hard to get through Linus. Sometimes he's got a packet dropping rate of 95%, I think, on emails. But it's understandable, because I don't know how many emails he's getting, but I'm getting enough, and I know he's getting more. The kernel is written in what I call object-oriented C and assembly. And this is not a joke. A lot of people think that the only way to write object-oriented code is in C++ and Java and all these fancy things, but you can write pretty good object-oriented code in C. Basically, you can do all the important things in C, and the rest is bloat in the other languages, but that's a different story. All the code in the kernel is GPL, GNU Public License, or compatible. I don't want to take a lot of time on the GPL because it's a long document, but generally, you cannot take BSD code from NetBSD and OpenBSD and just put it in the Linux kernel. The licenses are incompatible. However, if you want to write code which runs in both operating systems, which is a perfectly valid thing to want to do, then you can dual license your code. So you can say, this code can be either used under the GNU public license or some other license. No problems with that. Okay, so basic rules for programming in the kernel. You do not have a libc. You do not have the full get sock op, memcopy, string copy, all these hundreds and thousands of routines you have in userland. If you type man minus k and then get the full list or something, then we do not have all of this in the kernel. You have only a few basic functions. The rest you have to write yourself. I have seen terrible examples of people who are trying to link part of libc into the kernel. That's a very bad idea. You use C and no CC, no C++, that is not accepted. Linking C++ code in the kernel is a very bad idea. You should only use inline assembly where you really need it. So just because you think you can save two cycles in an open routine, which is a slow piece of code, there's no reason to write an assembly version for it. It doesn't matter. Only use it where it's really necessary. Don't put if def all over the kernel. Some people have used that in the past, and it's a nightmare to maintain. Floating point is not usable in the kernel. If you really need floating point, you should try to put it into longs or integers and do some tricks there too. You can normally do that, but floating point in general is not in the kernel. The reason for that is that when the kernel is doing context switching, it has to store the registers, and it does not store the floating point registers unless it's doing task switching between two tasks. Okay. Well, most of the time, you really don't need ifdifs. That's the whole point. If you write your code right, you rarely need to put ifdifs in the code. So that's actually the point of it, that often it seems easy to just say ifdif intel i386, then do this, or put inline assembly in. But the way you can often do it is to, if you, for instance, if it's a question of architecture-specific code, you put a macro, you define a macro which everybody can define for their own architecture. And then you don't get these ifdifs, which are very hard to read. You get a function which with a smart name which actually tells what it's supposed to do. And that way you can avoid a lot of this. Okay, I need to get going. Then one of the basic rules is that when you want to put stuff in a kernel, you really want to think about whether it needs to be go in the kernel or not. A lot of things really belong in user space, and if you just put things in the kernel, we'll end up with a 10 megabyte kernel and it look like some of the commercial Unixes. We don't want that. And kernel space is expensive. Basically, things which are put in the kernel cannot be swapped out. So whenever you take up another page of kernel memory, you have one page less of swappable memory. That can be a problem. So only put things in the kernel which really need to go there. And a lot of things can be done better in user space anyway. Having runtime configurable options in the kernel is way preferred over compile time options, because even though you know that your SCSI controller will only do 20 megahertz probing or whatever, the next guy who's getting a pre-compiled kernel from Red Hat or SUSE or something might have a different view about it. And for that, it's really preferable that he can set this thing without having to recompile the kernel, because a lot of normal users nowadays, they do not want to recompile the kernel. Private header files. When you're writing code, put your private header files next to the code, unless it's something which everybody should see. It's easy to explain when you see the source tree. And then write your comments in English. Both the code and the comments, basically. It may actually apply here. I put this in because I gave the talk at CERN, which is a multinational corporation, or not a corporation, research institute. We've got people from 20 countries there. And even though it's probably nice for you to write in your own language if you are not native, or if English is not your first language, it's really not good, because the next guy who's going to look at the code and try to maintain it will not. I mean, I can write my comment in Danish in the kernel, and there'll be like 5 million people on the planet who can read it. But it's not good, because these 5 million are not the main kernel developers. So write code and comment in English. It's really preferable for everybody. Okay, so what do you need for programming a kernel? You need very simple tools, basically. You need the GNU compiler. You need the assembler, the linker. You need GDB, the debugger, which is a good thing to look in the kernel, look at the code which is being generated. Then you need grep. You need an editor, so you, of course, need Emacs. You need grep and find are two amazing tools which you can find a lot of information in the kernel about, because how is it somebody doing this PCI probing thing? You just run a find grep and search for this PCI thing, and there'll be an example. It's extremely powerful. Everybody needs a lot of coffee. And then you need diff and patch. That's basically what you need. There's nothing special to it. You don't need fancy developers' tools which cost like $2,000 a year and licenses or anything. You have it all. Okay. So this is how the kernel source tree more or less looks. There's a few more things, but basically we have a documentation directory. It's a good place to look for information, because there's actually a lot of good stuff in there now. There's a makefile. Then we have an architecture-specific directory where we put in things which are specific to the various architectures, how to set up memory management, the initialization of memory management, interrupt handling, that sort of thing. Then there's a drivers directory, which has a ton of subdirectories as well now, where you have block drivers, where the IDE stuff goes to character drivers like serial, mouse, network devices, SCSI, ISDN, a ton of other stuff now. There's a file system directory where we have these 250 file systems Linux supports nowadays, or Then there's an include directory, which has, again, the architecture-specific include directories, which are called SM-ARC, so SM-M68K for the 68000, I386 for the Intel. Then there's a net directory for headers specific to the networking code, and the Linux directory for general Linux headers. Basically, the ASM on your particular architecture and the Linux directory will be exposed to user space. So that's why I'm saying you should not just put things in the Linux directory if they're not meant to be public to the rest of the system. It doesn't make any sense. Then we have an init directory where you find the main program, basically. That's where the kernel is really started. Inter-process communication for IPC. Then there's a kernel directory for various things, the scheduler, memory, scheduler, general system calls and stuff. There's a library which has some basic library functions, string copy, memcopy, memset, some of the things you really need. The library directory can normally be overruled by architecture-specific optimized versions. So there's a memory management directory. There's a modules directory where you are, if you're using loadable modules, the compiled binaries will end up in there. Then there's the net directory, which has all the networking code. And then there's a scripts directory, which has a bunch of scripts which are used by the kernel compilation project and other useful scripts. Okay. So how do you build a kernel? You get your source tree, unpack it, your CD down there. You run makeconfig or one of these other two terrible tools, xconfig, or for people who like these menu things where you can click and point and... then you run make dep for dependencies. You run make install. This is actually taking the point of view on the Intel. There's some of the other architecture where you just type make. Then you do make modules and you can install the modules. It's pretty simple, actually. I assume most of you have either thought about doing this or tried compiling your own kernels. If somebody sends you a patch, and if you're reading the Linux kernel mailing list, you'll see tons of patches. Then the way to apply it is to go down there, run the patch command with some various parameters, read the man page, make old config, that's very important, the old config thing, and then you go, the same thing is up there. Old config is important because it'll run through all the config options and then only show the ones which has changed. So it'll come out and ask you for the new ones. So we've seen in the past that people did not run make old config and they missed some very important new config options. So when Unix domain sockets turned into an option, which you could disable, then lots of people forgot to enable it, and they said, oh, X doesn't work anymore. Okay, so how's the kernel started? Oh, I have to be careful here. Basically, the kernel starts in this file. It's an assembly file, head.s, which does initial setup, which basically means you shut down the old operating system. On Intel, that does in practice means nothing because there's not really an operating system on the machine when you boot it into Linux. I don't count DOS as such. On the Mac, there's a lot of crap you want to get rid of, for instance. All this graphical junk they put up. Then they said in the, it does the initial memory management, MMU setup. It copies the kernel to the final location. Some systems you'll have virtual addresses when you load the kernel, so it has to copy it to a final thing. And then it jumps to what's called start kernel, which is in the main directory. Then the second step of kernel bootstrapping is there's a long list of things which are started in this order. I've just put in the main ones. All my slides are in the handouts or in the proceedings. I think I didn't make any modifications. Even the date should be right in the proceedings. All my slides are there. I forgot to say earlier that there are some code examples which I'm going to skip, so more or less skip over here because large code examples are not fun to look at on slides. But they might. I put them in because I think they're useful. Later, if you want to program your own kernel, you can look at these examples and say, that's what the idiot was talking about. Okay, so what do we do now when we run some architecture-specific initialization? Just the final memory management, the swapper, and all that sort of thing. It sets up interrupts, traps, software interrupts. It starts the scheduler. It's initializing the console. It sets up a bunch of caches for various things. It starts the virtual memory subsystem is started down there. Then it boots up the rest of the processors if you've got more than one. And it initializes all the buses. Most of you have PCI in your system. ISA buses are not initialized because they're extremely dumb and they can't do anything. There's no smart probing or anything. You just hit the device and hope it's responding. So it starts up all the bus code. Then you start running the devices and the file systems. Then it mounts root, and then it executes the init process on disk. So, I mean, it's very simple, right? But basically, what can you conclude out of this is that there's early initialization of the memory subsystem and all the driver and the, well, memory subsystem and interrupts. And that means all the drivers, when you get to the point where you actually want to start the device, writing device drivers, everything is running. And that makes life so much easier. Because in the old days, back in the 1.2 kernel and before that, you would initialize the drivers before you had a lot of things. So if you were writing loadable modules which were loaded from disk later, you'd have to treat things differently compared to if they were written as device drivers. Because when you load a loadable module, everything is initialized. Otherwise, you can't read it off disk, obviously. So this makes life pretty easy. And you can write code which is you don't have a lot of if-diffs, whether it's a module or not. And you have the full system running, which is, well, it's really nice. You can run the normal memory allocation, kmalloc thing, and stuff like that. Okay. Before I go on to the real thing, I want to say a few words of what's called the virtual file system. Basically, everything in the kernel is more or less all the device drivers are attached to a virtual file system of some sort. You all know that in a Unix system, everything goes through file descriptors. You can run open and close and mmap and read and write and normally on everything. So all device drivers and file systems, actually, I consider a file system to be a device driver as well. It's just not accessing hardware. It's a virtual device driver, if you may. We have the kernel virtual file systems, and then some of the subsystems themselves are defining sort of sub virtual file systems. So you have like the networking code or the SCSI code is registered as a general interface in the virtual file system. Then the device drivers are registered in an interface which is sort of a layer below. You probably have to look at the code to see what I mean. A module you're writing can provide just a subset. So if you're writing a specific device driver for a character interface, or maybe character interface is a bad example, but for instance, a networking device, you don't want to be able to memory map a networking device. It doesn't make any sense, because a networking device is supposed to receive and send packets. And memory mapping a networking device just makes no sense. Like writing to a mouse doesn't make much sense either. I don't know if you can get a mouse where you can actually write to it and you can have it run around on your table. But anyway, most of the common functions and the behavior of these are that there's some more than the ones I'm going to put on the slides, but I'm going to put in the important ones, and then you can interpolate from there if you want, or you look at the code when you want to write it. But the most normal ones are you need a probe init type thing. So you need to find your device, or you need to find out it's a file system and initialize it, allocate some data structures, whatever. Then you normally need an open function, so you can, if it's a network device, you can open it up and tell the card that now you're allowed to take packets and whatever. You need a close function, which is doing the opposite. Then you can do a read, which will prepare and provide data to the caller. I mean, lots of these functions are actually equivalent to the functions a user space program would call. So you can read from a device if it's a readable device. You can write to a device, so you can make a write function. For net devices, it's a little bit different because they have what's called start xmit. You don't just write bytes out on the network. It goes through the stack and it produces packets, and these are transmitted, so you always transmit a whole packet at a time. But it's in principle, it's the same thing. Then you can do memory map. That's just this wonderful thing they put in Unix. But again, that can be, for instance, for device registers. It can be for control structures. On frame buffer devices, you want to be able to memory map the video memory so you can access it directly from user space. That's what X3 is doing. You can have I/O controls, which can change settings or do other special things. I mean, I/O controls, you can do whatever you want, basically. For certain hardware devices, you want to have interrupt handlers. It's pretty obvious. And if you're writing modules, you'll have special init module functions and a cleanup module when you're removing it. So these are the main functions you'll see if you're writing a device of your own. Okay. PrintK is really the most valuable debugging tool we can have in the kernel. If I have code which is crashing randomly or in some specific place and I'm not sure where it is, I tend to just throw in a bunch of these print Ks and see where it stops. It's very simple and it's very, very efficient. It's a very good way to sort of nail down, this is the routine which is screwing the system up. So print K, it prints messages on the console. Very smart, right? It's got a bunch of priorities. All these ones are listed there. And the way you use it is basically you have this print K and you can set a priority or you can not put it there. If you don't put it there, I'm not sure what it defaults to, but it's probably current info. And then you can have a string of text, and then you can put, I mean, it works just like printf. You all know printf. But this is a very valuable thing. And these priorities sort of decide what the kernel is doing with it. Because some of these, if you're running syslog, it means that some of these priorities, I think things like kern info probably doesn't go into syslog. Or kern notice maybe, but some of these will not go into the syslog, and some of them will, and some of them will not be printed on your screen, and some will. I was actually asked to ask people to use the mic when you're asking questions. I don't know if I really don't care whether people want to ask questions now or later, but if it's getting a problem, we'll keep them for later. But please.
Okay, there's no comma after the print K kern info. Is that intentional or accidental?
That's intentional. Actually, these priorities will put in, I think. Smaller than bracket, a number, and a greater than bracket, and that's being interpreted by the syslog D daemon, or klogd, is it? So, yeah, that's intentional. Otherwise, you would have a problem leaving it out as well, because otherwise you would have to put in a comma. If you left it out, there would be a comma and nothing, and I'm not sure the C compiler would like that. Okay, next step. Now you found out you want to do some stuff in the kernel. You need some memory. That's the quite common thing. You need memory for your data structures. So we have in the kernel, we have three ways of allocating memory. And they have three different purposes. Sometimes you can use them all for the specific things. Sometimes it makes more sense to use one or the other. We have kmalloc and kfree. They're very similar to malloc and free in user space. And the only constraint on these is that they will only give you as much as 128 kilobyte blocks of memory. If you need 128 kilobyte blocks of memory in the kernel, you have to think about what you're doing because kernel memory is expensive. And if you start allocating a lot of these chunks, it's actually taking up a lot of system memory. However, they've got one nice feature, and that's the fact that all memory coming out of kmalloc, kfree is one contiguous block of memory. And a lot of the cheaper devices you can buy for PC will not do what's called scatter-gather. When you're doing DMA from the device to memory or the other way, it'll want one large block of memory and start from one end and go through it. Smarter devices can take a table saying, the first block is this long and is there in memory, and next block is this long and there in memory. It's called scatter-gather. But a lot of the junk devices, if I can put it that way, will only take contiguous blocks of memory. So therefore, kmalloc and kfree is good for this sort of thing. Then we have... The thing with kmalloc and kfree is also you can request a 32-byte structure, and you'll get it. It will not take a full page. Whereas you can also use what's called get free pages and free pages, where GFP is a priority, and there's an order, which is the order of the number of pages. So order of 0 will give you one page, as put here. An order of 1 will give you two pages. These pages are also contiguous in memory, So if you know you need 64K total, you can also get it this way. There's two priorities which are common. There's the GFP kernel and the GFP DMA. That's actually a thing I should have put here. The GFP DMA is meant if you want to allocate memory for like ISA bus devices, which are supposed to do DMA, which can only access the first 16 megabytes. If you have a sane PCI device, you just want to put GFP kernel here, not GFP DMA, when you're allocating. These priorities actually go to KMalloc as well. I don't know why I didn't put that there. So the GFP DMA is really if you want to do ISA bus DMA. We have a problem which we need to solve later. Just one second. We have one problem which we need to solve later, and that's when we want to do 32-bit PCI DMA on 64-bit machines. But for the time being, that's not a problem. Yes?
Where does GFP Atomic fit into this?
That's a good question. I think you need GFP, if I remember right, you need GFP Atomic from Interrupt. I'm pretty sure it's from Interrupts. Normally I just copy my old code and use it again, so I can't remember exactly.
Well, I found it the hard way because it kept on complaining at me that I was.
Yeah, I think if you're allocating from interrupt handlers, you need to do it in an atomic way. Okay. Otherwise, funny things can happen.
I just wondered if you knew the difference between the two. Other than that,
I think that's the difference.
Okay.
So, okay. On top of that, we've got something called vmalloc and vfree. That's if you need large blocks of memory, but you don't care whether they're contiguous in memory, you can allocate them with this, with these functions. So if you have a device which can take these scatter-gather blocks of memory, you can actually use vmalloc and set up, tell the device, here's the first page in memory, here's the next page in memory, like that. And that's good for the system because it's easier for the system to actually allocate these virtual blocks of memory than it is to get these contiguous blocks because when the system is running, and it's been running for a long time, and it's running out of memory, it's going to fragment the memory. And at some point, you may not be able to get these blocks you want. But also with vmalloc, you're not limited to 128K.
What happens if I want more than 128K?
If you want more...
contiguous block.
If you want a bigger block, you're screwed. Basically. Right now, you're... Pardon? Okay, so the question is, if a device needs more than 128K of contiguous memory, right now there's no method for doing that. That's just how it is. I know some of the frame-grabbing devices need more, and there's some special patches, but they're quite ugly and they're not in the kernel.
One trick that was done for that process was to tell the kernel, to lie to the kernel and tell them you have less memory than what you really have, and then the person directly addressed the remaining memory as a DMA buffer. I've seen like 128 megabyte buffers done that way.
I haven't seen these patches. I know there's no official patches for this in the standard kernel. There may be extra things. But it's rare that you need it. There's some of the cheaper video grabbing devices, I think, cannot do scatter gather or something where you need this. But there's work in progress in solving this. This is the problem. And there are a few legitimate usages for it. And this should be solved. I know people are thinking about it. But right now, there's no general solution. There's a patch out there called Big Fizz Alloc or something like that, Big Physical Alloc, but I've never used it. I've never had to use it because I've been lucky I had smart devices to write code for. Okay, so in the kernel, we've got a bunch of address spaces, and this is actually quite important because when you're thinking about a PC, you've got physical memory, it starts at address 0 and goes up from there. However, some architectures do not have their physical memory at address 0. Some of them got it in multiple blocks, spread over multiple physical blocks, so one at address 0, one at address 512 megabytes, stuff like that. So we got what's called physical memory or what's real host memory. You rarely want these addresses. Then we got what's called bus shared memory, which is normally for PCI shared memory. That's normal. Things like the memory on your video card will be considered as bus shared memory. And bus shared memory is not the same as physical memory. It's very important. First of all, the bus shared memory is not accessible on the system in the kernel. You have to map it in a special way with something called IO remap. And to access the memory itself, you need to use these special functions called read byte word long and write byte word long. And this is because that even though on Intel, the PCI bus memory, when you map it, will show up as real, it looks like real memory. And you can actually adjust addresses. But on certain architectures, especially some of the older alphas and other systems, this will show up in a really strange way. I'm not quite sure how it works. I suspect that it could be that it might be that the alpha is 64-bit, the PCI bus is 32-bit, so it mapped 4 bytes, had a hole, 4 bytes hole, or something like that. So if you do not use these macros, your code will often break miserably on other architectures, especially the alpha. So the rule, basic rule here is always use these. Then we got virtual kernel memory. And this is actually the addresses you're seeing when you're inside the kernel and you're writing code. You've got virtual kernel addresses and not physical addresses. On some architectures, virtual kernel memory is the same address space as the physical kernel memory. You've got the same, you've got a one-to-one mapping. The Intel used to have this, but it doesn't anymore because there were some smart, good reasons for moving the kernel in the virtual space. So rule number one, virtual kernel addresses and physical addresses are not the same. So an address which you get out of the bus shared memory or the real host memory, you cannot just access it. If it works for you, you're lucky, but you should not rely on it. It's a pain it's a pain to debug other people's code which is doing this. And then on top of that, we got the IO address space, which is like everybody who's had a PC in the past has tried to fill with jumpers and get this thing to get everything to go in at the same time and find holes for all the devices. So you've got the ISA PTI style IO address space. And those you need these in byte word long macros and out byte word long macros. Is it just me or is it badly focused down in the corner? Okay. So now we have multiple addresses, address spaces. We also need to be able to convert between these. And that's the important bit. First of all, the physical addresses you really don't need, or very, very rarely. Because one of the things is that a PCI bus, the address space, the physical memory on your system may look different to the PCI bus than to the host processor. So the PCI bus may see, if you have physical memory at address 8 billion, 8 million, anyway, 8 and then 7 zeros, hex. If you have physical memory there on your system, it may look like address 0 to the PCI bus, and so the bus mastering device out there. So you have, when you're feeding, when you're setting up DMA to your device, you'll normally tell the device that you need to tell the device where in its address space it's going to send the data. And therefore you need to give the DMA bus mastering device the bus addresses, what we call bus addresses, and not the physical addresses. The physical addresses are really only relevant to memory management code and nothing else. So we have two macros to convert between these two, virtual to physical and physical to virtual. But I would say like 99.9% of the time, you'll never need to think about these. There's one other issue, and that is you can have physical memory mapped twice virtually. And so the physical to virtual conversion is not always a one-to-one mapping. That's another thing one should think about. But that goes down here as well for the bus to virtual. Frame buffer memory, video memory, you sometimes see it's mapped twice. And converting it and then expect to be able to convert it back to the same address is not reliable. But anyway, these are the ones you want to, virtual to bus memory and bus to virtual memory. These are the ones you want to use if you want to do DMA in device drivers. Okay, I think I've said it enough times now that there's a good chance people remember. Okay, so now you know how the address spaces are. You want to find out basically whether your PC's got a piece of hardware, this piece of hardware which you're trying to address. If you have an ISA bus, then all devices can have interrupts, They can have device shared memory, either PCI bus shared memory or SBUS memory or ISA shared memory or something else. And they can have these I/O ports, at least on PCI and ISA buses. So these are the things. First of all, you know, when you want to write a device driver for this new sound card from this new fancy company, you know, if you've got the documentation at least, whether it's supposed to have I/O bus spaces or memory mappable registers, or whether it's got a big buffer of memory, video memory, or maybe sound memory. So when you want to write your device drivers, you want to find out where are these different blocks located in memory, or where are they on my system, if they're there. So if you want to find an ISA device, basically ISA is very nasty because it does not give you any smart resources for finding your device. So the way to do it is that you know how your device is, you know what chips are on this device, and if, say, you have an old LAN's Ethernet card, the good old LAN's chip, you know how this chip is programmed. So you know if you write to a certain register, you should be able to read something else back somewhere else or in the same register. So the way to find an ISA device is basically write something there and read back and see if you get back what you expect. And you have some sort of smart pattern, so you write a couple of bytes out to the card and you read them back or read back something else. And if you get back what you expect, you sort of say, ah, hey, I found my LAN's Ethernet device. But the problem with this approach is that maybe there's another device out there and not the card you want. And this card will blow up if you write these bad values to it. But that's just trial and error. So this is the wonders of ISA. It's quite nice. You can get some really funny things out of this. I'm actually amazed that the kernel is as good at finding ISA devices, especially networking cards, as it is. For interrupts, it's just as funny. The trick there is that once you found your device, you know where your chip is. You want to find out what interrupt it has on your PC. But there's no mechanism for that either. So what you do is you disable all the interrupts in the system, and then you tell the device to generate an interrupt. Well, you disable all interrupts but one. And then you tell the device to make an interrupt. And if you found the interrupt it's using, you'll get an interrupt. If not, then you go to the next one. Disable this interrupt and enable the next one and try again. And by some point, you should get an interrupt and you found your device, the interrupt line for the device. Good thing is that ISA does not support shared interrupt. Otherwise, this would be really funny. The alternative is to let the user specify the information like you do in Windows and all these terrible things where you have to put in and say, my network card is at address 2F8 and blah, blah, blah. All that's, you can do that as well. You can do that in Linux. I think a lot of the sound drivers need this. But in general, ISA device probing is pretty bad. And it's pretty dangerous. So it's something to be a bit careful with. I think you've all figured by now that I do not like ISA. PCI, on the other hand, is really nice because this is actually ripped out of one of my own drivers and modified slightly for the slide. But what you know is that all PCI devices have what's called a vendor code and a product code. And then what you do is you use something called PCI find device. There's also something for finding a group of devices, say find networking device. Because they also have a group code, so there's a networking and video and a couple of other things. But what you do is normally you would say, okay, this is from a card from a high-performance networking card, actually, I wrote a driver for. Well, the company's called Essential Communications, so they have a vendor code called Essential. And then the card is called the Roadrunner. And then you run this thing, basically, until you don't get any more devices back from it. So you have a loop, which... This one will return null if it finds one of these devices. And so you initialize the device in here, and then it'll go up and see if there's another card in the machine and like that. So, and with the PCI, you can read all this. When you use this one in the PCI dev, I just call it PDEV up there, it'll tell you the interrupt line. It'll tell you the base address for the I/O space, if there's I/O space on it. You can get the shared memory. Device shared memory addresses, and all of this you get out in a nice way. You just read it out of this data structure, and it's there. So no reason to do funny probing, which will make the machine explode and stuff like that. It's really nice. And what I did up here is just the example. Often you will have a private data structure attached to your device driver. So for each device in the machine, you have a private structure for the device, and there you can put all this information in. If you look in the device drivers in the kernel now, in drivers, nets, SCSI, all of them basically, and search for some of these PCI functions, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of examples of how to do it. One thing I should mention here is that we used to have some function called PCI BIOS underscore blah, blah, blah. These are the old ones from 2.0 kernels and before that. The new official recommended ones are the one called PCI. I haven't listed all the functions because there's PCI find. There's something to set bus mastering bits on the PCI. And the best way to do is the best thing to do is really to go and look at other code and see what they do. But the ones without the BIOS in the name are the recommended ones to use. Okay. So now we found our device. The device has an interrupt line, and you want to register this one so you can put an interrupt handler in for the device. You use the function called request IRQ. The stuff in bold in the text is normally supposed to be real examples of things you can, real code, function names and stuff. So you use request IRQ, and PCI supports what's called shared interrupt lines. That means you can have multiple devices which will pull the same interrupt line. And this is not a problem. It's very, very easy to handle in your device driver, so you shouldn't worry about it. ISA will only give you one device, one interrupt. But some of you may know that these PCs tend to have a limited number of interrupt lines. The classical number is 16, and with the new APIX, it's 24. But it's still too few. I have colleagues at work who tend to throw like 4 SCSI controllers and 3 or 4 networking cards and a bit more in their PCs. So you actually run out of these interrupts pretty quickly. Yes?
How does the kernel handle multiple
shared interrupts?
How
the kernel handles shared interrupts? Basically, what it's doing is that if it's getting interrupt 5 and I don't know. I don't know the PC number, so it may be a bad example. But if it's getting into, say, interrupt 5, it'll have a list of interrupt handlers registered for interrupt 5. So it'll call the first one. When it gets back, it calls the next one. When it gets back, it calls the next one. And so what the device driver, the interrupt handler is supposed to do, the first thing you do in your interrupt handler is, you see, this is the example. So this is the device init function. It registers the interrupt. I just call it my interrupt. The interrupt number is dev minus the dev pointer IRQ. And this one means shared interrupt. If you put a 0 here, you'll get one non-shared interrupt, okay? And then you can give a string with a name, and then if you get an error message back, you couldn't get the interrupt line, maybe because somebody had allocated. So down here is the interrupt handler itself. And the first thing you do here is to pull a register. All these devices normally have a register, which will tell you whether it's got an interrupt pending or not. So basically, normally the first thing you'll do in your interrupt handler is to go out and read the status register from the device itself and say, did you pull an interrupt, yes or no? If not, you just return. Otherwise, you do your stuff down there. So it's very simple. It's normally a one-liner to do. So supporting shared interrupts is easy. Yes?
When would you not want shared interrupts?
When I would not want shared interrupts? You have a case where if you have devices which have very small buffers and they're supposed to run at very high speed, like if you have serial lines which are supposed to run at 200 megabits or something in a serial line, and you have small buffers, you want the minimal possible latency whatsoever, but it's rare. It's very rare. One of the examples I can mention is the serial on the old Amigas. The serial ports, they're non-buffered. Got no FIFO on those ports. So in order to not lose data on the serial lines, you want to run the fastest possible interrupt handler. But general rule, use shared interrupts. There's very few cases where it's not applicable. I mean, all the decent networking cards and stuff I know, you just do it. It doesn't really cost you anything. And you also, with shared interrupts, you you may actually also see that if you have two devices sharing the interrupt line, so while one is pulling the interrupt, you might get into the interrupt handler while the next one is pulling the interrupt. And you call this interrupt handler as well on the way. So you catch the interrupt there. So it's not, generally it's a good thing to use shared interrupts. It doesn't really cost you anything. Did I press the button or not? For these I/O ports, Linus is actually redesigning the interface for this right now. It's not done yet, so I'm describing how it works in 2.2. First of all, device shared memory. There's no right now. There's no mechanism for allocating it. So if you have two device drivers trying to, basically, if you have say a device where the registers are in shared memory, and on the same card you may have a SCSI chip and a serial line and an Ethernet on the same chip, and it's giving you one 4K block of memory with the registers in it, then you'll need to map this thing for each individual driver, the one running the Ethernet, the one running the serial, and the one running the, what did I say? The last one. But there's no method of preventing somebody else from allocating the same device right now for shared memory. For these I/O ports, there's something called request region, where you basically give it the address, the port number, the starting port number, the size, and the name. But this function doesn't really do anything. It's just more for information. So you can read out and say, oh, this guy's allocated this and this guy's allocated that. It's more for information than for actually management, this one. I think you can actually request the same thing twice. I'm not quite sure, but I think you can. One general rule is that if your device can do both shared registers, shared memory, many PCI devices will allow you to do both shared memory map registers and I/O port registers. And you all heard about this Minecraft scandal and stuff, this terrible test that somebody did and said Linux was so slow and that sort of thing. Anyway, after that, a lot of us have been looking at the code and see what was wrong, and we found some things in the Linux code which was less than efficient. So, I mean, things are moving on there. As Linus said, it's just a different type of bug report, and that's absolutely right. Anyway, what we found recently, I think it was Ingo Molnar who actually pointed out that some of the things are a factor of 5 to 10 faster when you're using memory map registers than I/O port registers. This is from a private email, but there were some. They did some benchmarking on that, and a lot of devices are actually a lot faster because it doesn't go out on an ISA bus style thing. So if you have performant devices, I mean, for a serial line running or a mouse device, it really doesn't matter because I mean it's running at 9600 baud or something like that. It's nothing. But if you're trying to run at gigabit speeds, I'm working on gigabit Ethernet drivers at the moment, and we're talking packet rates of 40, 50, 60,000 packets a second. And there it starts to matter. Then you want to do IO map, memory map registers rather than IO map ones. It makes a big difference performance wise. Okay. So when you're writing an interrupt handler, it's very simple. First of all, the interrupt handler will block other parts of the kernel. So you don't just want to, write your full story in the interrupt handler if you can avoid it. Because there may be other devices which are trying to generate interrupts, and they are more sensitive to losing data or latency and stuff like that. So you really want to reduce the work the interrupt handler is doing to a bare minimum. So you acknowledge the interrupt to the chip. Many chips will have you read a register or set a register or something to tell it, yes, I'm servicing this interrupt now, clear it. Then you do your work, which is just 10 lines of code, of course, and then you get out of the interrupt handler, ASAP. That's the general rule for interrupt handlers. Do not write big memory copies or fancy graphic drawing or whatever in the interrupt handler. As little as possible. To get around this, because sometimes you need to do extra work, which is fairly slow but doesn't really need to be done straight away but pretty soon after, we have something called bottom half handlers. These are, what do you call them, sort of software interrupt type of thing which is running at a lower priority. It runs so all other, it's a handler which is run as the last thing in the interrupt handler, but It's running with all interrupts enabled. So if a new interrupt comes in the meantime while you're running this, the interrupt will be serviced first, and it'll go back and continue with this thing. And that solves a lot of the latency problems. So you can do your heavy work in the bottom half handler. There's only 32 possible bottom half handlers. Half of them are allocated right now. But there's some generic ones you can use. And I recommend you use the generic one unless you really have a good... I mean, there's one for the SCSI code, and there's one for the networking code, and then a few other device drivers have marked their own, which I'm not sure they need it. But there's a generic one you can use. I'll have an example of that in the next slide. So they, as I said, they run last in the handler, and with all interrupts enabled. It's not hard to use these. I actually had to change the device driver recently to make it more performant, and I had to go back and read my slides to find out how to do it. I never used it before. I'd never tried using bottom half handlers when I actually wrote the slides. I just went in and looked in the kernel, and when I wrote these slides, I haven't written all this code. So I went in and looked at what are people doing, and then I put that on the slides. It's not too hard to understand, actually. So anyway, the list of bottom half handlers is in this file, so you can find them there. And the funny thing about the bottom half thing was that when I put it in my code, it actually worked. So here's one of these famous code examples. You have a structure. This is for using the immediate bottom half handler, which is a generic one everybody can use. You have this on the slide. But what you do is you have a handler. You have a small data structure you allocate. You put a few things in there. Basically, I don't know what the sync does, actually. But on the next, I'm not sure either. I don't use it. I think you can chain them. But you put the handler and the data pointer. So you have a function and a data structure, which is attached. So you can use the same function if you have 10 devices. It really doesn't matter that if you have 10 of these Ethernet cards, it doesn't matter. You don't need 10 handlers. You just have whenever you issue the queue, the bottom half handler, you just set the data pointer to the different one. So the handler will go in and take out information out of the data pointer. So it's quite easy. You set this data structure, you queue it, and you mark the immediate bottom half handler with the mark BH. That's it. Very simple. But again, it's easier when you write the code to find out how it actually works. Now we can look at the example. And I tested that example, actually.
Quick question there. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Who can't hear me?
Okay.
Okay.
The table can't hear
you. I can repeat your question otherwise. Okay.
I noticed that the structures you're using are static.
Well, that's just for the example. Normally, you would use dynamic structures in allocated structures.
So you'd have to use kmalloc or...
Often what you do when you initialize a device, you allocate one big structure for this device. And if you need one of these bottom half handlers, you'd allocate the data structure as part of this block. So you just declare this big data structure, and in there you put this thing, and so when you allocate your device, you allocate this whole block. You don't want to allocate one for each. You don't want to allocate the data structure for your registers and one for your register point and one for this queue and this one, that queue. You just put them all in data structure and allocate one big block.
Okay, that's very interesting, but in fact I was trying to get at a different
point. Oh, sorry.
No, I that's important what you mentioned. It seems like you might want to have several of these... bottom half handler requests pending at once for a device. You might get backlog where the device is ahead of you.
Okay.
I'm worried that if you only allocate one, you could be stepping on yourself.
What you want to be careful with there is not to queue the same bottom half handler before the first one has run. The same goes for timers, by the way. I tried this one. I made this mistake once in one of my drivers, and it kept issuing the same timer. And it kept issuing it, so suddenly I would get an explosion of timers, and the machine died. And the same goes for the bottom half handlers. Do not try and issue the same bottom half handler before you finish with the first one. However, it's actually not too dangerous, if we go back, because if you're putting the same information into the same bottom half handler again, and you mark it down here, the queue thing will run it twice. If you queue it twice, if you just mark it, it'll just... tell the thing run this bottom half handler, but you really don't want to. It's your job to make sure that you're not issuing the same handler twice. That's your job. And the same goes for timers.
So somewhere in your own data structure, you'd have a representation of...
You can do that, or there's also a way to remove this thing from the queue. I don't remember the function name, but I'm sure you can find it in the kernel.
Thank you.
There should be a way for that. Okay. Timers, that's a very important thing. There's the classical way of waiting in the kernel, which is while 1 or while something, or 4 I equals 0 to 5 million, run a loop. That's a very bad way to do it. It's also called busy waiting if you keep polling the device or you just take a long delay in the kernel for no obvious reason. You normally don't want to do that. It's quite expensive. If you do that in an interrupt handler, you're blocking everybody else for a long time, and the kernel can do better. I'm sure Windows does a lot of this, but we don't want that in Linux. I mean, we want Linux to be efficient, right? So you have timers, and these timers can be used for a lot of things. One of the things is that we have a Jiffy's timer. It's a global variable called Jiffy's, and it's ticking at hertz. Hertz is a defined constant in the kernel. On most architectures, hertz is 100. So this Jiffy thing is running at 100 hertz. But on the alpha, it's actually 1024. I think it's got to do with the way they use some timer in the CPU or something. I'm not sure. I haven't done that much alpha programming. But the timers can also generate interrupts. So to avoid this busy waiting, you can generate interrupts with these timers. And once a timer has expired, it'll not run again before you queue it again. But, as I said, it's a very bad idea to keep queuing the same timer without it being expired first. So, yeah, that can make really funny things happen. I tried it. Yes?
One more question about interrupts. On some architectures, there are fast and slow interrupts.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could maybe briefly explain what the difference is and whether you would use one or the other.
Can I go through this one first and come back to it? Okay. If you have a timer, again, you have a timer function and you have a data pointer. This comes in as an unsigned long, but you just typecast it to a pointer. And when you issue your timer, you can make that data pointer whatever you want. It can be a value, just a constant of some sort, which tells your timer function that, oh, I've waited for 5 seconds, or it can be something totally different. It can be a pointer to a data structure which you use. So what you do is you allocate a timer list item. Again, I did it statically because it looks better on the slide. Or it takes less space on the slide. It doesn't look better. Then you can init your timer, which inits the data structure with the basic values. You put the data pointer in. You put the function pointer for this one. And you set the delay. And the delay, you says, is you take the current Jiffy's value, and you set plus delay multiplied by hertz. So to wait 5 seconds, I would set delay equals 5 multiplied by hertz. That works on all architectures. If you just put 500, it's going to work differently on the alpha than the Intel. And then you add the timer. And then if you have this case where you want to modify a running timer, which is quite common, because if you have a device, a networking device, you want to see if the networking device is stuck, then whenever you, for instance, in the transmit interrupt handler, get an interrupt saying, now I've transmitted a package, you can go in and modify the timer and say, okay, I've wait another 5 seconds until we think we're stuck. So you can use mod timer for that, which is basically the same as delete timer and add timer again. But that's the good way of doing it. Then you do not get these storms I talked about before. Okay, any questions for timers?
When your H10 is too high, because it's high, such as an alpha.
Yes.
There's a lot of overhead. Why is it one so
big? A lot of overhead, the hertz value on the alpha. Yes and no. I think the alpha one is too high. Because what it's going to do is this one will give you 100 interrupts a second for the timer, and the alpha you'll get 1,000. And there's a little overhead with entering interrupt handlers and going out again. Personally, I think the alpha one, if possible, I don't know the alpha architecture good enough to say whether this was a right or wrong decision, okay? So I'm not trying to blame anybody, but I don't personally like very much that they have 1,000 interrupts a second on timers. So it costs a bit of overhead. I heard some arguments on the Linux kernel from some of the guys who designed it, and I think they're doing the same thing in OSF1. which is now called Digital Unix and True 64 or something terrible. DEC people or compact people tend to love that you say OSF1. Personally, I think it would be nice if it was smaller, but 1,000 interrupts a second is not too bad. I think Ingo said he had done 25,000 interrupts a second or something on PCs, something like that. What I'm seeing with Gigabit Ethernet running at about 50, 60 megabytes a second, I'm seeing 8, 9, 10,000 interrupts a second. So it's still a small fraction. Okay, to get back to the interrupts with... let's see. I probably have it on the slide somewhere. I don't have the... the thing with prioritized interrupt handlers versus normal ones. There's one other flag you can set here. This one is the shared one. There's also one called SA_interrupt. They say this one will actually enable interrupts again on the local processor while it's running, but not for this source. SA_interrupt will block interrupts on this processor while running. So they're the so-called fast ones. I've seen people use these SA_interrupt handlers for a lot of things where they're not necessary, the so-called fast interrupts. Because the general rule with interrupt handlers is that you should be allowed to be disturbed by somebody else, because somebody else may have something running which is really, really important. So unless you have something which is really, really important and cannot take latency, then you don't want to run the normal ones. But yeah, the fast ones will just block everything while they're running. Or block everything on this particular processor while they're running, because now we have X processors in the machine. That's the difference. I strongly recommend not to use the fast interrupts unless you really know why you want to do it. Most of the examples I've seen where people have done it have been for no reason, in my opinion. Does that answer your question? I don't know where you're hiding. But I'm trying to get rid of those because they're inconsistent with the rest of the code. They're inconsistent with the rest of the code, and that means when you want to write a driver, which will run on both on an 68000 and on an Intel, you'll have to do a lot of defines or call a lot of if-defs for this stuff, and it's pretty annoying. For those of you who don't know the 68000, it's got something called prioritized interrupts. So you've got level 1 to 7 interrupts. And everybody, the guys who designed it, I think somebody said it was the BSD guys, I don't know, or people at Berkeley, but the idea was that some interrupts are more important than others. But my claim is that you can get around this by just allowing interrupts to have these cases where you have interrupts which should not be disturbed. Oh, I'm getting too far. You have interrupts which should not be bothered by others, and you have interrupts which can be. And so the serial ports without any buffering is an example of an interrupt handler which would run and run with a priority, the high priority. Whereas a networking device, you don't really care if you disturb for a short period and go back to processing the device. So the fast ones you want to do for things like serial ports which do not have buffers on them, or other things which are really critical to being serviced in a hurry. But there are very few devices like that nowadays. So. Okay. Timers. Everybody knows all about timers now. Did I mention that before? Well, we have what's called user space and kernel space, right? Kernel space is a funny area, but some people want to run these user space programs which will want to take data out of the kernel, read data from disk and stuff like that. So you need to be able to take data from the kernel in your device driver and send it down to the user space program. The nice way to do this would be memcopy, but you can't do that because they're virtually different. On Intel, they're actually mapped both in the kernel space right now, but on some architectures, they're not. On Intel, they do this because it's a lot more efficient than copying between the two spaces. But what some of you may also know BSD, Unix, the old way, where they have something called copy in and copy out. These two always confuse me because I cannot figure out which one is copying into the kernel. It's probably the first one, and which one is copying out, but I'm not sure who's who here. On Linux, we've got something similar, There's one called copy from user, and there's one called copy to user. That's pretty self-explaining what they're doing, right? And you have the to and the from and the size. And these two functions are kind of tricky. There's a couple of these macros which are a bit hairy if you look at the code. But basically what it's doing is it's taking a copy from user, and well, both of them will take a destination pointer, which is copy from user is a kernel pointer, copy to user is a user space pointer. It'll take the from, which is the other way around, and then the size. And if one of these two fails, for instance, if you're trying to copy to memory which is not mapped in the kernel, if you're trying to copy to a random address, it'll return the size of memory, the length of data not copied. So if you get non-zero back from one of these and you want to return, you should not just return the length, but you should return something like minus e fault. I may have that. I'm not sure if I have an example on the next slide. I don't remember. No, I don't. Okay. You can see it in the kernel, but that's these. I'm not quite sure why Linus decided it. I think it's because he wants to make sure that you can, if you get a fault copying, you can clean up. You know how much to clean up if you get an error. And that can be important because you don't want to risk that somebody's doing this to fake memory and then get access to some memory, some old data in the memory they should not have seen before. That's a security problem. Then we also have the option of taking just a simple data word, which can be either a byte, a short, an integer, 32-bit, or long on 64-bit architectures, which is 64-bit. And these macros are the get user and put user. Get user will give you has a destination address. Get user. Dest is actually a destination variable where the thing will be put in. This is a nasty macro because it's also returning an error code. But it's also got a destination register or a variable where you actually put your value in. So this one it's sort of a macro with two output functions, two output values. It's pretty strange. But the thing is, you check whether you get non-zero back from this one. If you get non-zero back, you have an error. And destination is where the error return value is put, and the pointer is pretty obvious. The other way around, you just have a value you want to put to this user space address. And these functions are type testing. So if, I think it's the pointer it's checking on, if the pointer is of type char, it'll put a char. If the pointer is of type short, it's going to put a short. I think that, I'm pretty sure it's the pointer it's using for checking. I can check that afterwards if anybody wants to know. Yes?
The error code can be bigger than a char.
Pardon?
The error code can be bigger than a char.
Well, char, short, integer, or these macros will check of the type of this one. See what I mean?
But you say that the error code is put in the destination when you return non-zero.
Yes.
So if it's bigger than char.
A destination is not a pointer. It's a variable. It's a short or an integer or, I mean. Okay. The thing with these is that they're pretty slow in principle because they have to do range checking and they have to make sure that you're allowed to access this address. So if you know you're going through a whole list, you want to get 20 words in like this or 20 words out. What I'm thinking about, I think actually it's not the pointer it's checking on, but the type of the argument here. We can check that afterwards. The thing is, when I get into a problem like this, I just look at the definition of these functions. I'll see how it works. They include asmux.h. You have these two, which will not return error codes, and they'll not do range checking. So once you know you're actually accessing legal data, if you know you're accessing a data structure of, say, 40 bytes, and the first one and the last one is valid, then you're pretty sure that the ones in between are valid as well. So you can use these ones to sort of skip some of the checking and make it faster. Okay. But The checking versions, both these and the ones up here, all return zero for successful access and non-zero for an error. And they return the amount of data not copied on error. Further questions on these? Okay. It was 10:45, we should take the break, right? I think it was. 10:30? Okay, we'll take the break in 10 minutes then. Okay. As I mentioned before, you sometimes want to wait in the kernel. One of the examples is that you have a card where you're downloading firmware, where there's a processor in the card. You're downloading firmware to the card, and you start the card. And you want to wait for a while to give the card sort of time to spin up and initialize and do whatever it's doing. And instead of busy waiting in the kernel, there's a couple of options here. Well, actually, this is for busy waiting. The other thing you want to use the timers. But here, you can use the wait queue for device-ready firmware up for long delays. That's the one I showed before. There's something called U-delay for very short delays. Some devices, things like I2C devices I've seen, I don't know if you know I2C buses, they're, if you have nice code for reading it, you just want to use that. If you want to bit flip the device, it's hairy. But some devices will say, require that you, once you set this register, you have to wait for a microsecond or 10 microseconds before you can read the data. That's normally in the data books. And that you can use U-delay for. But U-delay is valid up for 10, maybe 20,000 microseconds and not more than that. If you try to U-delay 200 or 1 million microseconds, do not expect it to work. It's a bad idea. For that, you can use GIFIS. And there we have some macros now. This GIFIS is a 32-bit... No, it's an unsigned long. So in 32-bit architectures, it's a 32-bit entity of a counter. And running at 100 hertz, it's going to flip after about 240 days, or maybe it's 400 days, I don't remember. It's probably 400 days, because Solaris 2.5 used a 32-bit integer, signed integer, and after, I think, 147 or 247 days or something, the machine would blow up. Guess why? It actually happened to us at CERN, because suddenly we have power cuts once a year or something. And at some point, a bunch of Solaris machines all blew up at the same day. And it showed up, it had been 140 days since last time they'd been shut down, all of them. So, but on Linux, it's a 32-bit counter, full 32-bit. However, you still have the wrapping to deal with. And the older kernels are not safe for this. I think 2.2 should be pretty safe for this. And what you do is you use these macros, which says time before equal to, time after and time after equal to. And the example here is you wait while time before, you can do a wait like this, while time before GIFIS and the new value. That's a busy wait. And this one, this way of doing it is safe even for the wrapping. You don't want to do this in most situations, but there are a few situations where in device probing, the firmware example I mentioned before, where you're sort of at the boot time of your device, it doesn't matter so much if you're doing busy waiting. But if you're doing it at runtime while you're moving data, it's a pain. So, okay. Can I borrow your... I have a watch. I just want to see what's coming next. Locking mechanism, semaphores. Okay. Okay. We're actually at getting to slide 2 now. The agenda part 2. We may want to take the break now, because what's coming up now is all related. It's multiprocessing and that sort of thing. So if we meet back here, 22 11.